Okay, good evening, everyone. I want to thank Elise Stern for sponsoring tonight's lecture in loving memory of her father, Joseph, whose yahrzeit site was observed. I thank you for your generosity. May his neshama have an aliyah. We're going to learn tonight about Operation Brothers and Operation Moses, and also Operation Joshua. So the immigration of Ethiopian Jewry to Israel. Now, the story begins a long, long time ago, exactly when, it's hard to say, but I want to begin the story in 1977. Menachem Begin became the Prime Minister of Israel in 1977 in a political revolution where the Likud party finally took power after being in the political wilderness for a long time. And one of the first things that he did was to tell the head of the Mossad that he wants the Mossad to work to bring the Jews of Ethiopia to Israel. Why? I don't know exactly what motivated him, but certainly Begin had a soft spot in his heart for the non-Ashkenazic elements of the Jewish people that had put him into power. And let's bring up back a lost tribe of Bnei Israel. The status of Ethiopian Jews in the eyes of the established rabbinate was unclear. For many, many years, there were those in the Orthodox rabbinate who said that the Ethiopian Jews were not Jewish at all. They were given the term falashas, a very negative term. The Ethiopians themselves preferred the term Beit Yisrael, the House of Israel. How many were there? Some say in the 1970s there were about 25,000, if you take away the Falashmura, those who converted to Christianity, just those who were of pristine Jewish religious affiliation. What were the origins of the Ethiopian Jews? Nobody really knows for sure. Some say they were from the 10 lost tribes or the tribes that went down to Egypt in the first temple period. Some say they were Yemenite Jews who crossed the Red Sea. Others say they weren't Jewish at all. They just converted to a religion similar to Judaism 700 years ago. We don't really know. But they existed, and they had a very strong Zionist or traditional Zionist impulse that we're going to go back to Jerusalem one day, to the Promised Land. This was their firmly held belief. Now, Israel had diplomatic relations with Ethiopia for much of its early decades. And when Haile Selassie was the emperor, there were cordial relations between the two countries. But despite the cordial relations, there was no real attempt to foster Aliyah from Ethiopia. Question is, why not? And the answer is actually on both sides, there was a hesitation. On the Israeli side, there were doubts about the Jewishness of the population, and therefore the rabbinate was an obstacle. Also, Israel was a socialist, white Ashkenazic country, probably not very interested in bringing in black Jews from Africa. After all, the treatment of the Yemenite Jews and some of the other Sephardic communities was far from perfect. And if that's any indicator, the Ethiopians wouldn't have had it too good had they shown up either. But from the Ethiopian point of view, Emperor Haile Selassie, the Lion of Judah, who considered himself a descendant of King Solomon and Queen Sheba, he believed that the Jews should not go to Eretz Yisrael, because rather the Ethiopian people of all religious faiths, Muslims, Jews, Christians, should all be united under his leadership. He says, how could I let an element, a tribe of my Ethiopian people leave? I have to stay, keep them all home. This was it was not a malicious thing on his part. It was like an ideological thing. He's the king of Ethiopia. He wants his people to be his people. All right. In 1974, Mengistu kicked out Haile Selassie and took over the country. And in 1977, a deal was struck between Ethiopia and the State of Israel to allow for the release of Jews in return for military aid, because Ethiopia was constantly fighting a civil war against the Eritreans and the Tigrayans. They have breakaway provinces here and there, and the regime in Addis is never a stable one and always fighting off hostile elements within the larger borders of Ethiopia. And so a deal was struck and 125 Jews arrived in Israel. Ethiopian Jews were flown directly from Addis, I think it was directly from Addis to Israel. But then the politicians messed up. And this is going to be a common theme in the treatment of Ethiopian Jews. The politicians messed up. What happened? Moshe Dayan, who was the foreign minister at the time under Menachem Begin's government, revealed publicly in an interview in Switzerland that Jews were coming from Ethiopia in return for military aid. And the whole point was this deal was supposed to be quiet, secret. And Dayan messes up and openly acknowledges it to the press. So Mengistu has to shut the pipeline off. The deal is off. No more Jews coming to Israel from Ethiopia. Now, this was a shame, a very unfortunate thing for for the well-being of the Ethiopian Jews, but it came at an especially bad time or inauspicious time, because right around that moment is when Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, and by far the most significant chief rabbi of Israel ever, other than maybe Rav Kook, because of his power and his how respected he was by his constituents, Rabbi Ovadia ruled that Ethiopian Jews are halachically Jewish, and therefore eligible under the law of return to come to the state of Israel. Now, he also added that they should do a Giur L'Chumrah, a conversion for stringency purposes, which in the eyes of many people was a humiliating ritual and gesture just to placate the hardliners. And this made a lot of ill feelings between Ethiopian Jews who arrived and the establishment. But the point is they were allowed to come under the law of return. So, what are Ethiopian Jews going to do now? Well, they're in Ethiopia, except when they're not. Why would they leave Ethiopia? Because the civil war made life impossible there. And Jews, together with millions of other refugees, began pouring out of the country and going to Sudan. And the question is, in these makeshift encampments in the Sudan, how do you find Jews? The truth is, they didn't openly identify as such for fear of being, anti-Semitic attack, reprisals, whatever it might be. You keep your identity secret. So if Israel was interested in rescuing some of these people, how do you even find them? Not such a simple task. So the Mossad agents were sent by the Mossad head, Yitzhak HaKachofi, to try to find these people. But the agents that were being sent were not the top flight agents, because this was not considered the most important mission of Israel's spy service. The more important missions were the ones that involved, preventing Arab regimes from getting nuclear weapons and preventing Palestinian terrorism. This was going to be, lower guys on the ranking within the office of the Mossad. Now, who's going to go? All right, so fine, some agents are going to go. They have to have some kind of cover story. One of the cover stories is to pretend to be an anthropologist. Because if you're pretending to be an anthropologist, anthropologists are basically white guys who go to non-white parts of the world under the story that I'm studying them for, human interest, for the sake of human knowledge. You can get away with anything as an anthropologist. You can be a fish out of water and be an anthropologist. Okay? Now, the slow-moving reality of Sudanese life meant that basic things were hard to come by. You have to travel, you have to have a car, you have to have gasoline. Could you guarantee these things? You can't just go to Avis or Enterprise and get a car and fill a full tank. Basic things to do the work that, let's say, in a European environment would have come easy. Just put down a few euros and you're good to go. Or there were no euros back then. For a few German Deutschmarks, you'd be okay. But in Sudan, even with bribery, it's hard to get the tools necessary to do the kind of reconnaissance that needed to be done. Okay, well. In the fall of 1981, a straw company was established. This straw company was in Europe to focus on tourism in Africa, specifically tourism in the Sudan. And the Mossad leased an abandoned holiday villa on the Red Sea coast of Sudan, the Arus Holiday Village. It had been built a decade earlier by an Italian company, because the Sudanese government had promised that they were going to pave a road from Port Sudan to this holiday village, and it was going to be a way to build up to expensive European tourism, deep sea diving, the snorkeling, the scuba diving, the windsurfing, all that stuff in the beautiful setting of the Red Sea coast of Sudan in a lagoon. Okay, very, very nice in theory, okay, if you could pull it off. So the Italians had abandoned it when Sudan basically was going nowhere and the road wasn't built and this was going to be a lost cause. They had left behind some local employees to make sure that these 20 bungalow cottages were not destroyed, just to maintain it in the absence of any tourism and any Europeans overseeing the project. So the Mossad takes it over and sends some agents to run this place with the goal supposedly of being building up Sudanese tourism. Now, the plan was for the Mossad to use the committee men. Now, committee men were Ethiopian Jews who dedicated themselves to finding fellow Jews in the refugee camps, bringing them to a rendezvous point somewhere in the desert, and then having Mossad agents pick them up, drive them long distance to the coast, not too far from the holiday village, and have the Israeli Navy then, take the handoff, put them on an Israeli Navy ship, and sail up to Eilat. That was the basic plan to be done time and time again between 1981 and 1984. All right. Well, the story as it's told by one of the agents who were there, Gad Shimron, the author of this book. Actually, you can't see it because my Zoom is blurring the image, but it's the title of the book is Mossad Exodus by Gad Shimron. He was a journalist. He was a Mossad agent a few times. He's in all the documentaries on YouTube. He was there for a few years, off and on. And as he explained it, you got to Khartoum on a false passport, supposedly in the tourism business, and you had to drive 700 miles from Khartoum to Aarhus. Now, the truth is, it wasn't 700 miles. It was really only about 300 miles. But the only paved road, or a highway, so to speak, in Sudan was in a semicircle, so it should have been 300 miles as the crow flies, was actually 700 miles. Okay. How do you survive a 700-mile trip? Well, it's a challenge because the vehicles were in horrible condition. The gasoline was hard to come by. You had to bribe people to get extra canisters. There were deep potholes in the road, and there were also huge boulders in the road that were used as sort of warning triangles to, for a car that had a flat tire. It changed the flat tire, it would put up a boulder so they wouldn't get killed, but they wouldn't move the boulder. So this was a crazy situation to drive 700 miles from the capital city to the coast. Nobody paid any attention to weight limits on vehicles. You loaded up all the gear you possibly could have onto your Toyota or your whatever truck you had, and you try to make it all the way. What about security checkpoints? I mean, what are these people, these agents, going to say to the Sudanese police and Sudanese army officers when they're about, they're caught on the road? The answer is you got to think fast and come up with some kind of cover story. Now, the holiday resort was about 40 kilometers or 25 miles away from Port Sudan, which, if Khartoum was a dusty and decrepit capital, Port Sudan was an even more decrepit seaport. They got to the bungalow colony, and the locals were there, and the locals thought that money was no object. After all, these white guys were spending loads and loads of cash on equipment, on generators, on boats. Okay, so the locals thought this was the real deal. They didn't know that this was an Israeli operation to rescue Ethiopian Jews. They thought this was a tourism operation. And the Mossad's job was get the place ready for tourists, high-end tourists who would change the economic fortunes of the region. The problem is the appliances didn't work. The electrical grid didn't work. The water supply was questionable. All these issues had to be resolved. There were boats, there was diving gear, there were generators, and there was some equipment, communications equipment. And the Home Office back in Tel Aviv said, don't run up expenses too much. Don't run up expenses. Well, how are you going to get the place ready for tourism if you can't run up expenses? They had fun. They did water skiing, windsurfing. The guys had a lot of fun, but it was dangerous. And there were moments where they almost got killed. They solved the utility problems by bribing some local officials. How do you bribe a local official? You give a donation to the local orphanage. That was the euphemism. Donation to the local orphanage. In other words, the guy's pocket. When the Mossad guys left the village to do their various operations to pick up the so-called brothers, the Ethiopian Jews were known as so-called brothers. When they went to go get the brothers and they were gone for a day or two, the local employees wondered, hey, where are these guys going? There needed to be a cover story to cover your tracks in front of your own employees. So at first they said, well, we were going to visit the attractive Swedish nurses at the hospital in Kassala, which was about 50 miles away for amorous rendezvous. But that only worked so many times. Eventually they'd say we'd have to go to Khartoum to pick up air conditioners and so on and so forth. But the locals kept quiet. They didn't say anything because they were getting paid good money and the food was good. So they didn't want to rock the boat, even though they were suspicious that maybe these white guys are up to no good or something illegal. Okay. Well, morale was low because they were waiting for the operation to commence. And finally, it's going to happen. The brothers are meeting them at the rendezvous point. The leader of this job was Danny. Danny was the only guy there who wore a yarmulke. He was a religious Jew, and he was a believer in Hashem. And he said, "The Ribbono shel Olam zal help, God will help us. Everything will be okay." The others were more like, precision-oriented tacticians. They wanted to know that we have a spare tire in case we get a flat tire, that every I is dotted and T is crossed, and we're not going to run into a problem that we don't anticipate. But Danny was a Kadosh Baruch Hu zal help, God will help us. The Mossad guys carried no weapons. Why no weapons? Who needs a weapon? A weapon's just going to get you into trouble. You're not going to beat the Sudanese army in a firefight, a couple of guys against a whole army unit. So better not to have any weapons at all. You use your guile and your smarts to outwit the opponent. Well, the brothers were on their way. Hundreds arrived. They came quietly and without a sound. You wouldn't even notice they were there if not for the whites in their eyes and their teeth. Because they were dark-skinned, it was nighttime, you didn't see anything, it was pitch black. All right, well, they were very, very quiet, which was necessary, because if they make noise, the whole thing is going to get blown. There were four trucks, ultimately on four trucks, actually really only on three, because the first truck was empty to serve as a diversion. They carried 175 people. They packed them in like sardines. Okay, and these Ethiopian Jews had to survive multi-hour car ride, truck ride, packed very tight. If you get stopped, don't reveal that you're Jewish. If you need a cover story, you say these are Ethiopian refugees who are going to work on a farm near Port Sudan, but don't say they're Jewish. Don't mention the Jew word. At every checkpoint, the lead car bribed the guards with cigarettes and rusks. French bread, a cheap version of French bread, rusks. So the security guards, they were happy to just get their Marlboros and a couple of biscuits. There was a car accident at one point. There was a pileup, but nobody made a sound. Everybody stayed quiet, and there were no injuries. They rested for the night in an open field, and they set up primitive tents for them to have some shelter. And the menstruants went to a separate tent. The Nidas, they went to a separate tent. Because the Ethiopian Jews still practiced a very old world form of the Hilchos Nida, that the women have to go into the yonder. Okay. Well, they get to the sea, the handoff is made to the Navy SEALs, and aboard the Israeli naval ship, the INS Bat Galim, the Ethiopian Jews get to Israel. Brilliant execution. The reward for this brilliant execution was a bunch of boxes of Jaffa oranges with the word Jaffa scraped off so nobody would get into trouble, so that nobody should know where the oranges came from. Okay. Well, While at the holiday village, certain Hebrew words entered the Sudanese lexicon. For example, French fries became known as dakin dakin. Why? Because the word dak in Hebrew is to chop fine, like in the pita maktoris, okay? And so the guy was making hash browns. The Israelis didn't like how thick the hash browns were. He said, "No, you got to chop it a little finer." So dakim dakim became the Sudanese word for French fries. All right. Now, they brought in a hotel and food consultant because if we're going to have fancy European tourists, you got to have a good menu. And this place has to look presentable. Well, an Ethiopian army platoon showed up 1 week. They didn't know this was an Israeli spy operation. They just know it was a bungalow colony. And they got good treatment. And for that week, veterans of the Yom Kippur War on both sides played soccer with each other and had a good time. But one side knew that about the other side, but not vice versa. Interestingly, they were talking about Middle Eastern politics. And when it came to a discussion of the Palestinians, the Egyptians who were being hosted by the Mossad made a comment, something of a genocidal comment. One Palestinian in the Nile is pollution. All Palestinians in the Nile, solution. Okay? So goes to show you that the Arab world had no love of the Palestinians. The guy who came to serve the food, in the name of Apke, he was a survivor of Auschwitz. And to him, helping out in the rescue of Ethiopian Jews was his fulfillment of Zionist aspirations, that he was helping others in a time of crisis get to Eretz Yisrael. Okay. There were some spies who showed up. There was a British spy named Christopher. He didn't claim he was a spy. He claimed he was just a tourist, but they figured out he was a spy, and so on and so forth. On the next go-round, they picked up 172 brothers at Gedaref. And it should have been much more. There were supposed to be 400, but there was some kind of snag, some kind of delay. And the question is, do we wait for the other 200 or do we go now? And as is almost always the case in tense situations where life is on the line in enemy terrain, what do? You don't wait, you go now. So they left right away. Even though there were hundreds of others who could have shown up very quickly thereafter, they took the 172 and they made their way to the water. Okay. Now, getting to the water was easy. The challenge was at the beach because the Israeli Ministry of Defense under Ariel Sharon decided to change the handoff. Whereas originally, the brothers were taken out to sea by the Mossad agents in rubber dinghies and then brought on INS vessels. The new policy was the Navy comes all the way to the lagoon and picks up the brothers from the lagoon, not out at sea. So the challenge for the Mossad guys was, how do you light the lagoon at night so that the Israeli naval vessels are able to enter and not crash on the coral reefs and get stuck and stranded and cause an international scene? So they used these light sticks, but they were stuck on poles in the water, and that's how they lit the way for the Navy to come in and pick up the brothers. But the problem is that we've got a problem. Some of the brothers, well, before we get to the problem, some of the brothers didn't realize you can't drink seawater. They had never been to the ocean before, so they wanted to quench their thirst, and they tried to put cup into their mouths, ocean water, and they didn't realize it was salty. So it goes to show you they were very, very primitive. But the problem is the whole operation blew up. They got caught by Sudanese soldiers. The Sudanese soldiers may have thought these were smugglers. They had no idea this is an Israeli operation to rescue Ethiopian Jews. They thought it was just smugglers. And so, as the last boat miraculously was pushed out to sea, and only four Mossad agents were left on the ground at the beach, the Sudanese said, "Hands up!" And they pointed their Kalashnikovs at them. At this point, those who were on the boat figured these guys are goners, and our whole operation in Sudan is now finished. There's no way we could ever go back. But as it turned out, it didn't come all crashing down. My favorite part of the whole history of Operation Brothers is a 1 minute interaction between the leader of the group, Danny, and some Sudanese soldiers. He had to think fast. They had no guns. They had a knife, but no guns, and they had Kalashnikovs in their faces. So Danny all of a sudden yells, "What are you doing, you fool? Are you out of your mind shooting at tourists?" So he pretended like the Ethiopian brothers were tourists going scuba diving at night. And he continued and said, "I'm going to complain to your chief of staff. Can't you see we're organizing night diving here for tourists? You must be out of your mind. Who's the idiot that made you an officer?" And the guy with the gun very sheepishly said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know." So with quick thinking, a real chacham, he was able to escape the situation completely. And the Navy out at the ships was contemplating a commando rescue operation to save the four Mossad agents. They were going to come in guns blazing. And they had to quickly on the radio say, "No, don't do it. Don't come. Everything's okay. If you come up with guns blazing, that's going to make it worse." Okay, fine. So the ships go on their way back to Israel. The question now is, having gotten caught, even though nobody got shot and killed, and they got away with that particular episode, could they continue to do smuggling of Ethiopian Jews out of the country based out of the holiday village at Arus? Or should they shut down the operations and go back to Israel? So in examining this, we have to understand something. Had it been an intelligence mission that the Mossad was on, an intelligence gathering mission, they probably would have packed it up and gone home. You know, you got caught, you got lucky to get away with it, but basically you got caught, you pack it up and you go home. But this was not an intelligence mission. This was a rescue mission for Jews in a horrible country, dying in refugee camps. And so they regarded it as a betrayal and an abandonment if they were to leave Sudan and leave all the Ethiopian Jews behind. So it was determined, we remain, we're going to stay, and this job is going to continue. But the sea route had run its course, and there needed to be a new way to get the Ethiopian Jews out of Sudan and into Israel. So if you can't go by sea, what's your other option? By air, airlift. And don't think that Sudan is too far away. After all, in 1976, you know, 6, 7 years earlier, at Entebbe, Uganda, the IDF had done its, performed its mission admirably, so they could fly far. This was not too far to pull it off. All right. Well, the Mossad agents go back to Israel temporarily to get training in operating a Hercules C-130 plane, because the C-130s, like was the case in the Uganda episode, are going to be, you know, wide-bellied. You shove a lot of people inside of them and you pick them up and you go. But you have to know how to operate them. It needs practice. Remember that this is only 3 years after the disaster of the American rescue attempt of the hostages in Tehran. So in the back of the minds, or in the front of the minds of these Mossad agents, they're thinking Jimmy Carter lost an election because he failed to get the job done, because it ended disastrously. So don't mess up. If you're going to do this, do it right. They need to find and to mark a landing strip. This was more dangerous than a sea landing, because a sea landing was just, you know, a couple of Israeli Navy SEALs at the peripheral edge of Sudan for 3 minutes. But landing a plane means violating and penetrating Sudanese airspace, going inland some length of territory, and being on the ground for some protracted period of time, for an hour, who knows what it is. So this is serious stuff. And there cannot be a gun battle. There's no way there could possibly be a gun battle. You can't survive a gun battle. What happens if the plane is hit, is pockmarked with bullets? It won't take off. It'll crash. It'll be a disaster. So you have to find a spot which is near nothing, so far removed from civilization that nobody's going to know you were there, and there's been no remnant left behind. Okay. All right. So that's the job that they have in 1983. On Yom Ha'atzmaut, what happened was, 1982. On Yom Ha'atzmaut in May of 82, the guys were back in Khartoum. And the rule was in the Mossad at that time, if you are functioning in an enemy country and it's Yom Ha'atzmaut, you're allowed on the Mossad's shekel to go to the most expensive restaurant in town and have a holiday meal and raise a glass of champagne in enemy territory. So they went to the Khartoum Hilton, where they had stayed periodically, and went to the fancy hotel, and they raised their glasses and got roaring drunk and had a good Yom Ha'atzmaut in enemy territory. By the way, there was another fella there in the restaurant that same night, two tables over, who they didn't look at, but they knew who he was. Why? He was another Mossad agent, but on a different mission. That other mission was the Mossad was busy identifying Ethiopian Jews in the refugee camps and taking them in small numbers, not as big as the numbers going by boat and by plane out of Arus, but by small numbers using international aid organizations, you know, Christian aid organizations, to take them to Europe and from Europe to go to Israel. So that guy was running that operation, but compartmentalization. You're not supposed to know what he's doing. He's not supposed to know what you're doing. You don't talk to him. He doesn't talk to you. So they knew who he was, but they didn't even look at him. Okay. Now they're looking for a good landing spot for the plane. And there's poor intelligence about Sudan. Why does Israel have such poor intelligence about Sudan? The answer is because Sudan wasn't really an enemy of Israel. I mean, yes, Sudan had sent some token forces to fight against Israel in the War of Independence, in the Six-Day War, in the Yom Kippur War, but that was just token involvement because they're members of the Arab League. But really, Israel and Sudan have nothing to do with each other, and so Israel didn't maintain good files on Sudanese airspace and territory. So they're looking around, and they stumble across an old abandoned British airfield. Remember, the British had controlled Sudan from 1898 to 1956 when the Sudanese got their independence. So they found this abandoned strip. It was built in 1940. It was known as Erkowit or Carthage. And the runway was 1 kilometer long. So it fit the purpose. There was concern that there's anti-aircraft batteries near the port of Sudan. So they had to check out to see, maybe we don't want to get shot down as we're crossing over into the airspace. But they noted that it was rusted over and it had become a bird's nest and kids were playing in a park right nearby. So there was no worry that anti-aircraft batteries were going to shoot the IAF Hercules 130 out of the sky. So in May of 82, another rendezvous, the brothers go near the plane and they're afraid of the airplane. They think it's the belly of a beast. It was hard to do a head count in the dark. And some of the Ethiopian Jews wandered off because they had dust in their eyes and they were afraid to go on the plane. Ultimately, there were 130 Jews on that flight, on that first flight. The soldiers who showed up, the IDF soldiers, asked one of the Mossad agents, you know, how could we get away with this? The plane is making a tremendous amount of noise. Somebody's going to hear us. How do you think we could get away with, you know, this is a stealth operation? There's no way this is a stealth operation. And the Mossad agent told the soldier, listen, Boichigal, this is not Israel. This is Sudan. It's bigger than Germany, France, and Portugal, and Spain all put together. There's nobody near us for 20 miles. Nobody can hear a thing. And on the whole, that's true, that Sudan is a huge country, and you're in the middle of nowhere, and there's nothing to worry about. As it turned out, actually, there was somebody there. There was a Bedouin who was watching, and they got caught. And they weren't caught in the act, but because they later found out that somebody was watching them and the Sudanese investigators showed up and found remnants of iced tea cans, they knew it was foreigners who were there. They figured it was smugglers. They couldn't go back to that location. So it goes to show, even when you think you're alone, you're not alone. Now, the reward for successfully getting through this operation was air conditioners and windsurfers, all sorts of tchotchkes that they got. Now, the story developed back home in Tel Aviv that the agents who were working in Sudan were enjoying the sweet life, that they had it good, that somehow this was not a risky and dangerous operation worthy of admiration by the folks back home, but they were just living it up and having a wonderful grand old time. And it was called Operation Fun. But despite all the fun, there were plenty of downsides. You could get yourself killed very easily. Moreover, if you got a health problem, it could turn into a major problem. Gad Shimron, in his book, talks about how he broke a tooth one time eating lunch, and he had to go to Port Sudan to the only dentist in Port Sudan, who graduated from the Dental School of Alexandria in Egypt, and he thought that he was going to die. As it turned out, the dentist was good. He had primitive tools, no anesthetic, but you know, he did a good job. Okay, well, another problem was boring. You have to entertain yourself somehow. And in 1982, what happened? What was the major sporting event of 1982? Well, who won the World Series in 1982? I forget. Was that Baltimore? No, Baltimore was 83. The Cardinals won the World Series in 82. All right, but more important than the World Series was the World Cup. Spain was hosting the World Cup in 1982, and it was all over the TV. By the way, one of my favorite Israeli movies of all time is Cup Final, about the 1982 World Cup and how Palestinian terrorists and Israeli soldiers in the Lebanon War watched the World Cup final together with Italia. All right. So, but you want to watch the World Cup. The problem is at Arus, you couldn't get Sudanese television. Oy vey. So what do? You try to get Saudi television. What's the problem with Saudi television? So first of all, very tsnius. If there's any women, they turn it off. But also, King Faisal was assassinated about a day into the World Cup. And during the observance of the Shloshim, they turned off Saudi TV. Later, they would turn it back on after the Shiva because they realized they didn't want to make enemies out of people. So they had to watch on North Yemeni TV. Can you imagine that? I complain I can't get Verizon. They had North Yemenite TV. All right? But with enough tinkering, you could get the North Yemenite TV. So good. Well, then all of a sudden, the war breaks out in Lebanon. And when the war breaks out in Lebanon, this puts a real halt in the activities of the Mossad agents in Sudan, because there's no manpower and financial resources to rescue Ethiopian Jewry when there's a major war going on in Beirut. Just around that time, real tourists finally started coming to the holiday village. So this was supposed to be like a scam to cover for the rescue of the Ethiopians, but as it turned out, like they really ran a tourist attraction. So German and Dutch tourists started coming, diplomats from Khartoum started coming, and it's a happening place. Now they didn't go back to that original airfield because I said they had been caught. So they had to find a new airfield. And it wasn't easy. But they found one near Gedaref, which was 2 hour flight inland. Now this made it a lot easier for the Mossad agents because the rendezvous point of collecting the brothers and the spot where the plane would land were pretty close. So the Mossad agents had it relatively easy. But the IAF, the Israeli Air Force, now had a lot harder because they had to fly below radar level for 2 hours near the ground, getting inside Sudanese territory to the rendezvous point. Okay? But they did it. And in 83 and 84, there were many, many landings. And between 6,000 and 7,000 Ethiopian Jews were rescued over these years before Operation Moses. There were others who were trying to rescue Ethiopian Jews. There were some North American and Canadian philanthropic organizations, maybe some of you were familiar with those from those years, that were rescuing Ethiopian Jews, but one by one or in small groups and chartering planes to try to get them out. One of the guys who was running it happened to go to the holiday village, and privately, when no one could hear, he said to one of the Mossad agents, "I know you're Israelis and I know you're Mossad and I know what you're doing here." How did he figure them out? He said, "I saw you chopping your vegetables for salad. Nobody but Israelis chops it that thin." Now, okay, all right. He figured it out based upon the salad. All right. But then there was a plane crash and some people died. And at that point, the philanthropic organization said, "You know what? Fine. We'll just give you money. We'll let the Mossad professionals handle all the rescue efforts." Well, they reached a point in 1984 when the clandestine activities would come basically to an end, and not entirely, but for the most part, and the rescue of Jews would now be with the explicit permission of the Sudanese government. Why? How? How did an enemy government of Israel decide to make a deal to rescue Jews? The answer is that President Nimeiry, who had been president of Sudan for about 15 years at this point, That was one of these strongman types. His regime was tottering on the brink. Millions of refugees had fled Ethiopia into the Sudan, and there was skirmishes and clashes and this famine. It's a mess. And his regime needs help. He needs military assistance. He needs financial assistance. He needs help. And who's going to give it to him? The answer, the Jews. All right, Israel, in exchange for permission to extract Ethiopian Jews out of the camps and get them to Israel. Well, he doesn't agree to let them go to Israel, but he agrees to let them fly out of Khartoum Airport to European cities, and from the European cities they can go to Israel. So what would happen is Operation Moses, which began on November 21st, 1984, and would continue for the next 47 days and involve 28 covert flights, brought people to Athens, to Brussels, to Rome, and then from there to Israel. All right. The money involved, some of it went to the Sudanese regime, but some of the money went into the personal pockets of high-ranking Sudanese officials. General Tayeb took $2 million for himself in his own pocket. Which airline was going to handle this? So Mossad wanted to use Maof, which was a charter airline in Israel, a small charter airline in Israel. But El Al got wind of it and thought that now all of a sudden a competitor is going to have money in their pockets. So El Al muscled out Maof. But then El Al also couldn't get the job done. So they relied upon Trans-European Airlines, TEA, which was owned by a Jew and had experience traveling to Arab countries, even to Saudi Arabia. So the first flight on November 21st, 1984, there was a problem. There's always a problem. What's the problem? There were 250 brothers getting on the flight, but the plane only had 220 seats and therefore 220 oxygen masks. And the pilot, following the rules, not knowing that this is sort of an extra legal situation, said, "I can't fly this plane with so many people on board. There aren't enough oxygen masks. It's against the law." To which the Mossad guy responded, "You're going to get this plane up in the air in the next 5 minutes. I'm going to push you off and get another pilot." So, okay, he ignored the law, and the plane was off. The country began to know about the arrival of Ethiopian Jews, because Israel's a small country, and the soldiers knew, the government knew, the absorption center employees knew. More and more people, as each flight came in, were aware that blacks from Africa were arriving in large numbers in Israel. There was no way to conceal it. But in Israel, you can conceal even the things that can't be concealed. Even when half the country knows about something, if the censor, the military censor, says you're not allowed to talk about it, you're not allowed to talk about it. It can't be published in the newspaper. Well, okay, so everybody keeps quiet until there was a mess, a screw up. Nekuda magazine, a settler magazine from the West Bank, leaked that yes, the Jews were arriving from Ethiopia. And once it was leaked, even in a small publication, it got past the military censor. It was never submitted to the military censor. The foreign wire services now ran with it. And in the middle of a press conference on January 5th, 1985, Prime Minister Shimon Peres acknowledged that yes, Jews had arrived from Ethiopia. And a minute later, President Nimeiry said, "Show's over. Operation Moses is finished." So again, like in 1977, where loose lips sink ships, so in 1985, the same thing all over again. Now, Nimeiry had a problem. He was persona non grata in the Arab world at this point, because now everybody knew he was allowing Jews go to Israel. Those evil Zionists who will one day fight against the Palestinians. All right. So how did he cover himself? His answer was, "Listen, there are millions of refugees. My government doesn't investigate carefully whether they're Jewish, Christian, Muslim. We just let refugees go. They want to go, they'll get out of here. They went to European countries. Don't blame me." So he denied that he was in cahoots. He said, "Oh, I didn't know any better. Who knew?" But there's a big problem. A big problem. First of all, several thousand Jews, Ethiopian Jews, very sadly lost their lives in the journey from Ethiopia to Sudan through the desert. And Adhayomazet to this very day in the Ethiopian community, this is a big deal to remember the lost loved ones who never made it to Zion, never made it to Israel, because they never even made it to the rendezvous point to be picked up by the Mossad. Very, very sad. But also, there were about 500 Jews in the Gedaref refugee camp who were scheduled for the next day's flight as part of Operation Moses. And Operation Moses was canceled. And now these people are identifiable as Jews. You know, it's one thing if you're hiding your identity before they picked you up and nobody knows who you are, you just blend into the woodwork. But if you've been already identified as a Jew, you're in big, big trouble in Sudan. So how do we rescue these 500 Jews, the last remaining elements of what was supposed to be Operation Moses? The answer is come to the rescue, the United States of America. Vice President George Bush, George H.W. Bush, had a soft spot in his heart for the Mossad, having himself been a former head of the CIA. And at the urging of 100 US senators, by a vote of 100 to zero, right? They didn't have Rand Paul back in those days to mess things up, you know? So by a vote of 100 to zero, they said, you got to get those Jews out. We have to rescue them. And so Bush was able to arrange with Nameri in his final weeks in office on March 22nd, 1985, to have the US forces, Air Force, from Ramstein Base in Germany fly down to Gedaref and then fly up to Ramon Air Base, or then Ovda Air Force Base in Israel. So Israeli planes were not even involved. It was American planes from Germany to Sudan to Israel. Okay. 2 weeks after that, on April 6th, Nameri was kicked out of power. And then there was a big problem because when his government fell, the consequence of that was the rebel junta that took over tortured some of the high-ranking government officials to try to get information out of them, specifically information about the operations of Israel within Sudanese territory. So now, all of a sudden, any Israeli Mossad operative or whatever in Sudanese within Sudan's borders is in danger for his life. So what do they do? A bunch of them, four of them, run to the U.S. embassy, and then they run to the state the Khartoum station chief, CIA station chief's house, and he hides them in his house for about a month. Finally, they're able to ship them out of the country on a plane, getting them on the plane in boxes. So they had oxygen canisters and specially constructed boxes to take these four Israeli spies and get them out of Khartoum and back to Israel. So there was a certain degree of hakaras hatov, the gratitude that Israel should have had and the Mossad should have had, the Israeli intelligence community should have had to the CIA. And yet, just weeks after that happened, the biggest disgrace occurred, the opposite of hakaras hatov. What happened? Jonathan Pollard was arrested. So here, now the CIA was furious that here we went out of our way to rescue you guys, and you had a guy spying on us. Okay, so be it. Now, Arus, the holiday village, was cleared out in April of 85. One final C-130 landing in the middle of nowhere, about 80 miles north of the village, in some desert airfield. They got on the plane, flew back to Israel. Okay, no more Jews, no more Israelis in the Sudan. The show is over. Operation Brothers had rescued 7,000 to 8,000 Jews. Operation Moses, another 6,000 to 7,000 Jews. Now there are about 15,000 Ethiopian Jews in Israel, but many were left behind. Many had never left Ethiopia; they were still in Gondar province or wherever. So next time, 2 weeks from today, we shall continue and discuss what was arguably an even more convoluted scenario, Operation Solomon of 1991. So stay tuned. I hope to see you all in 2 weeks. Take care, everyone. And thank you, Elise Todaraba, for your sponsorship. Elias Neshama for your father. Take care.